Hi, I'm Richard Burnaby, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Lens, where I speak with inspiring people from all over the world about photography, the arts, travel, conservation, entrepreneurship, and creative culture. In this episode, I'm joined by Mike Albinsky. Mike's a Phoenix, Arizona-based extreme weather photographer specializing in stunning images of haboobs. Yes, I said haboobs. You'll find out shortly if you don't know already. Tornadoes, supercells, lightning, all expertly captured in stills and in a series of eye-popping time-lapse videos. We talk about storm chasing and the hazards associated with this seriously popular pursuit, risk-taking, approaches, gear, software, weather apps, and some storm-related science and even a bit of philosophy. A really, really fun conversation. Mike's website is mikealbinsky.com. Albinsky is spelled O-L-B-I-N-S-K-I, and his Instagram is Essential Viewing. Trust me, at Mike Albinsky. And we'll get to our conversation right after this short message from one of our partners. This episode was brought to you by Luminar Neo. Friends, do I love Luminar Neo, an essential part of my post-processing workflow. Luminar Neo helps photographers, like myself, with everything they could possibly need to edit and process photos that look amazing on the screen and in print. Luminar Neo was designed for both hobbyists and pros and includes the most effective AI-powered editing tools and extensions all in one intuitive and easy-to-use app. Whether you want to show off the finest detail in the fur of your wildlife photo, add a glamorous glow to your portrait shoot, or enhance that beautiful golden hour light in your landscapes, Luminar Neo has everything you need to improve your images naturally. You can use Luminar Neo as a standalone app on your PC or Mac computer, or, if you're like me, as a plugin for Adobe Lightroom or Photoshop, so you can keep your existing workflow while having access to powerful editing tools you just can't find anywhere else. I especially love the AI enhancement features, plus the use of layers and masking for localized editing as well. Learn more about Luminar Neo and how it can help you improve your creativity in photo editing by visiting skylum.com. That's skylum.com. Mike Albinsky, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Richard. I appreciate it being here. It's exciting, and thanks for wanting to have me on.
Does this feel familiar in any way?
Just a little bit. Just a little bit.
We're not going to talk about that. How you been?
I've been good. You know, the life, you know, kids and stuff, you know, it's been, I feel like the last half of last year, I kind of took a little bit of a, I don't know, like a mental break from a lot of things and got off social media and just kind of spent time with the family and, you know, new year resolutions. I don't really do that, but it was more of, okay, it's time to get back to it. So I'm fired up and trying to get ready for storm season in May.
Sounds great. I was just looking through your Instagram feed before jumping on here to do this. I guess it's one of your 2023 highlights, a tornado in Fort Stockton, Texas.
Is that right? Yes, that's right.
What made that experience one of your highlights of last year?
Oh, man. So without going too deep into the story, first off, I had Keith Lazinski, if you've ever heard of him. Mm-hmm. He's a big-time Nat Geo photographer. Yeah. And a couple others with him, along with him following me, we're trying to make like a brand film for Canon. So they were following along, and I had two tour guests. And, you know, when you are leading something like that, and I was by myself. I used to have my friend Brett help me, but he's been busy and I've gotten back to just doing it on my own. And so there's a lot of pressure. And I don't know if anyone knows where Fort Stockton is, but it's I-10 in Southwest Texas, and south of I-10. In that part of the world is just mountains and it's brutal. And so, but man, supercells build up off the mountains west of Fort Stockton and they turn into monsters. And I've seen a tornado down there a couple years ago in the mountains, in the distance, a white tornado. And we were all so excited, but it was so far away. Even my 135 could do, like, it was so sad. So we had to choose between storms up by Lubbock, which looked messier, and there was a lot of flooding the last few days. And I'm like, I don't want to get up there, be on a storm, and then we can't go anywhere else because the road stops us because it's flooded. Down here, though, it's like risk reward. If a storm goes up and it does something, will we see it? Is it going to cross in the mountains where we can't follow because the road network is just non-existent? There's like one road from there. And anyway, we go down there, we wake up. I'm like, we're going to do this. This is the isolated supercell that is what I like to photograph anyway, what I like to chase. It's easier. And this storm goes up by Fort Stockton. We're right there on it. It looks awesome. And then we go to this overpass over I-10, and I like to just, I mean, I like high ground. I like to be able to see things.
Just to see as much as you can in all directions.
Yes, I don't like things in the way. It's a little different. Some people, you know, they want something in their, you know, when you're out doing regular landscape photography, you're looking for foreground stuff, trees and objects and stuff. And I really like the weather, you know, to be the star a little more. So, you know, we go on this overpass and we just pull off on the shoulder on the overpass. So we're up about 15 feet and we're watching the storm, and these storms, they go up and then they take a dive to the southeast over there by Fort Stockton. So it's like, you kind of had to anticipate. I'm like, oh, this is about to dive, and it's crossing the freeway, and I can see the area of rotation, the wall cloud. It's like, it's spinning, and it's, I'm like, guys, if it's going to happen, it's about to happen. And we just see this funnel come down, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's on the ground. And my God, man, I was like, it was like this, you know, release of, I don't know, tension and pressure of like trying to get these people something amazing, you know, and then it just happens. And we're in the right spot. We can see it. We're up high. We can see the dust on the ground, and it just moves by. There's lightning like striking around the freeway and stuff. Most people went to the northern target, you know, some big time chasers I know. I was like, dude, are you going to come down here today? He's like, yeah. And then he's like, no, I end up going to Lubbock. And I'm like, oh. And then we saw that. And then after that, we went through all these mountains. And I sometimes you're on and I'm like, we got to get past this new storm down the southernmost road in Texas is all very close to the Mexico border. And we punched through another storm, got ahead of it before a lot of other people could, because then it just broke windshields. And from the giant hail, we got out in front and this thing dropped another tornado that was like almost would have been tornado of the year if we had been able to get any closer to it. But it was just, it dropped. It was on the ground for like 25, 30 minutes. It went from just like a cone tornado to a wide like stovepipe to like a wedge and all this dust. And you could see the whole structure and there was lightning. I mean, I was terrified. I was yelling at all these people with me. I'm like, listen. This is deadly lightning. It was striking all around us every like 4 seconds. Anyway, we got that one too. So we saw two tornadoes and man, it was such a like big deal, rewarding and triumphant kind of thing, especially when you're on something that, you know, makes other people a little sad that they weren't there and you got to win because storm chasing is such a up and down thing.
You had to make a decision. And you could have gone with the crowd where everyone else went, and you kind of took a risk and went another place, and you turned out to be right. And that made that – it was probably amazing anyway, but then it made it even a bigger highlight.
It was amazing anyway. No, it did. It's one of those things that you're like, I took a risk, I felt like, and it paid off. And that's tough because the other days you take risks and it, you know, you're a little stubborn, like, dang it, that didn't pay off today. But that's, you know, that's the weather, and it's tough to learn that lesson.
So I first discovered you, and I'm pretty sure it was on Instagram also. And of course, I was drawn to your dramatic, stunning photography. That's doesn't need to be said, but I think I followed you right away. But what I remember the most about that initial encounter was a t-shirt that you're either wearing in a short video clip or that you were selling. And it was
probably.
It was emblazoned with the words, I love big haboobs.
Yeah. That was my wife's line, pretty much.
What can you tell us about haboobs, aside from the fact that you like big ones?
I mean, a haboob is a dust storm. Another word for big dust sandstorm. And I learned that word from, looking at, it's a Middle Eastern Arabic word, kind of like the word monsoon, admiral, all these other words are kind of Arabic in origin. And so haboob is also that. And I had learned that word from seeing these photos from the Middle East, like monster dust storms. And I wish I could go back and, you know, find some of the ones I saw, but there was a few where it seemed we had like the U.S. Marines or Army or something. Our tents were set up and there was a wall of dust coming at them. And it was somewhere in the Middle East. And I'm like, my God, that's a dust storm. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that. And we get dust storms in Arizona and around Phoenix all the time in the summer during the monsoon. It feels like they're kind of a little less than they used to be. But
how are they formed?
The wall of dust, there's kind of different ways, but generally it's from thunderstorms that everyone's seen a thunderstorm probably, and you've seen the rain falling underneath it. Sometimes that downburst is so intense, especially out here in the desert where it's dry, that it's once that downburst of rain hits the ground, it spreads out like a wave almost, and it kicks up dust, and that like rush of air pushes that dust along. And a lot of times there's multiple storms kind of going up, and they're all, you know, dropping downbursts. They're creating outflow winds. They pick up dust. And then that outflow wind will in turn create more storms in front of it. Kind of like if you were running your hand across the surface of water just underneath it, you see that water raise up over your hand. Well, that's like lift. And so the wind rushing along the ground creates lift, and it creates more storms, and more storms go up, more downbursts, more outflow winds. And what happens is they tend to just keep coming, and the winds get bigger. They pick up dust. And then at some point you have a huge wall of dust. And we love chasing those out here. They're fun. And it's, you know, sometimes you don't know if it's going to be a really good one or not. So that's kind of how it goes.
It, and it was a huge haboob in 2011 that really yes. got your extreme weather career jump started, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. July 5th, 2011. I was still learning. It was, I think I'd been chasing for a few years, trying to figure out what I liked. You know, when you first start out, I just got pictures of clouds and I just went out and I'm like, man, this looks great. And it was nothing. Anything that I shot back in like 2008 or 2009, I wouldn't even save now, much less edit. Back then it's like, wow, this is so cool. But I was still learning. I've been out chasing. And that day, I got a text from a friend saying, hey, there's a big wall of dust coming, you know, and they were out in the southeast portions of Phoenix where it was coming from. And they sent me a photo or something, I can't remember. And I'm like, wow, that looks great. And I hadn't been wanting to chase that day because I'd been out for like 3 days. And, you know, at the beginning, you know, I'm married and I think we had a daughter. I'm like, I can't just be out all the time. I'm not making any money from this. This is ridiculous. But I'm like, well, I know right where to go, a quarter mile from my house, parking garage overlooking Phoenix. And if I can get this wall of dust rolling over town, it'll really show people what these are like and how they dwarf cities and buildings and things like that. So grabbed my stuff, went out there. And also it was my second day ever trying to time lapse anything. The first day was yesterday, the day before. And there was a little weak wall of dust out the town. So the next day, you know, I was practicing again. And then I go and I wish that I had known what I was doing, but I set up, wall of dust is climbing over South Mountain and coming towards town. And it was like nothing I've ever seen before. And as it got closer, it's just, you know, the sun had kind of just set, but there was still this like blue, and the dust was like a gray brown. Like it wasn't just like a normal kind of light brown dust storm. It was like a gnarly, like grayish blue in the sky. And it looked like that scene in Independence Day when the cloud is like coming over New York and a ship emerges. And the whole time I'm looking at this, I'm like, is there something going to come out of this thing? But but mostly it was like, I gotta capture this. And I was new. I had like a couple, I think I had a 5D Mark II and I might've only had one camera, and I was trying to capture it with my phone. My time lapse was set at JPEG. It was set for like 5 second intervals instead of 1 second intervals. Like I should have done, like all these mistakes, but captured it, posted it like an hour later. And it just went viral so fast. And it was just, I had friends saying that night saying, Mike, I'm sitting at a bar in Tempe and there's people watching your video on their phone next to us. And a friend is in Seattle going, Mike, your haboob video was just on the news up here in Seattle. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. And the fun thing about it though, related to the word haboob, is when I saw that, I'm like, this is a haboob if I've ever seen one. this is not some just dust storm. This is a monster. This is like the Habub photos I see from the Middle East. And so when I put that video up, I said massive Habub hits Phoenix, and it went viral, and it was on the news and everything, national news across, you know, the world probably. And so people started using that word, and it suddenly kind of went mainstream, which has pissed off a lot of, you know, locals and racist bigots out there that just, you know, they're like, we don't need Middle Eastern words. And also just old timers that live in Arizona that are like, it's a dust storm. I've lived here for 50 years. And I'm like, I've lived here for 48 years. I know what it's called. So anyway, it's funny. I like to rile people up about
that's
it.
Good.
But that was awesome. It really did. It changed everything for me.
It's apocalyptic looking.
Yeah. I mean,
end of times.
I knew when I was shooting, I'm like, this might be the one thing that gets me on the Weather Channel finally. Like, of everything I've done, I'm like, maybe this will be good enough.
That was
for
your
the Weather
goal
Channel.
At the time, is it get on the Weather Channel?
When I was standing there looking at it, I'm like, this is good enough for that. Like, yeah. This is cool. And not only was it that, it was, you know, CNN, NBC Nightly News, and just all over the world. And
wow.
I did, you know, the next morning I did two live interviews on the Weather Channel, and I had CNN calling at like 5 a.m. waking me up. I barely slept. And then, you know, after that, people were licensing it for things, for commercials. Al Gore licensed it for climate change talks, like presentations. And that's what really kind of – the viral stuff was fantastic, right? I mean, it's a cool thing, and it put my name out there. But it was the licensing afterwards that blew my mind, because I was not anybody – who was out to do stock footage to sell it. I just wanted to capture it in time lapse. I just really didn't even know that kind of business model or whatever. So that was eye opening.
Wow.
To me.
Great story. Did you ever want to become a meteorologist?
Everybody that I that knows me at growing up and in my 20s and 30s would always ask, why aren't you a meteorologist? Like, you should be doing this. And I think it was the math was too much. There's a certain point where, you know, I start zoning out when I'm learning about this stuff, because it's going into places that my brain can't possibly focus on. But I think what I learned, you know, through this journey, kind of starting off with that dust storm and just where I've come, is I realized what I really liked about weather, I think, was I loved it, obviously, but I also, for some reason, wanted to share it with people. I wanted to, you know, my neighbors back in the day that used to live by us, they made fun of me for years because I called them one night when a dust storm was coming, and I'm like, incoming, there's a storm incoming, or something. And they made fun of me. They would just be like, incoming, like all the time, to make fun of me about it. And it was something that in me that I needed to like share it with them. And so when I started, you know, getting into storm chasing, it was mostly photography, and then it was time lapse, and it was a way to share my passion with others. And so, you know, it wasn't really anything else. Being a meteorologist would be fine. And you are, in a way, you can share with people. If you get on a TV gig, or you're even at the National Weather Service, you can write discussions. I didn't really know all that at the time, but or at least in the National Weather Service stuff. But it just became something I wanted to share. And I think for me, you know, I love movies, and I really love soundtracks, Interstellar, The Arrival, Star Wars, you know, all these big sci-fi, you know, superhero movies. I love soundtracks, and I love what they do to your like kind of emotions and feelings when you're watching something. And so when I got into time lapse, after a few years, you know, I was capturing clips and stuff, and I decided to start putting some of it to music. And that's where I think I've always really wanted to be, which is like, this is what I love. And now I'm putting it to music to try to evoke emotions in a time-lapse film that is like, in some ways, it's really hard to take a bunch of clips of stuff and turn it into a story or turn it into something emotional. That was kind of something like, I want to make people, like feel what I'm feeling with this. And so that's kind of where it took me.
So aside from tornadoes and big haboobs, what other like severe weather events do you pursue?
Man, I love lightning. Lightning is probably the reason I got into it in the first place, which is, you know, I have memory of sitting out back of the backyard with my dad, and when I was probably 8 or 9, and a lightning bolt hit right behind our house, maybe 100 feet. I don't even know. But I remember it, you know, vividly to this day, and it's 40 years later, this moment of a big bright flash, and I couldn't see anything. Felt like I was blinded for 5 seconds. It was so bright, you know, as a kid. And there was a lot of cool stories that I've heard, you know, once I've started storm chasing, where, you know, there's a couple twin brothers that had their trailer park where they grew up with their parents. Their parents owned a trailer park, and a tornado hit it, and it like was crazy. Like their mom got like sucked out the window and then somehow came right back in, jumped on her two boys and held them down. And of course, this is their story, but jumped on top of them, held them down on the couch or something until the tornado went past and they all lived, but the place was destroyed. They were little kids. And when they grew up, when they got their licenses and were able to start driving, those two, they just wanted to chase tornadoes. They were fascinated and obsessed with
it. So it was one singular event that led them down that passion. And it's the same with you with the lightning bolt behind your house.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I figured, like, you know what? It kind of hit me when he was telling me, or telling at a convention, he was telling that story. I'm like, maybe that's my same origin story. I always like lightning. And I remember this vivid moment. And then once I, you know, started doing this, that's what I wanted to capture the most.
What is a supercell? And is that the same as a mesocyclone?
Yeah. Supercell, mesocyclone, basically the same thing. It's a rotating thunderstorm. Out here in Arizona, generally, there are the garden variety thunderstorms that happen a lot everywhere. They kind of pulse up and drop rain and move on and disappear. Out in Arizona, that's kind of the monsoon. We watch thunderstorms build up. They'll drop the monster downbursts and lightning, and then they dissipate. Other storms build up, you know, like I said, from outflow boundaries and other things. And that's because there's no spin in the atmosphere, and they call it shear. Out here, generally, like on a normal monsoon day, it's 10, 20 knots shear, pretty weak, whatever. On the plains, you get 35, 40, 50, 60, 70 knots shear, which is the speed and the determination of how the atmosphere is rotating. So when these supercells, they form as like basically a general thunderstorm going up, but as they're building up, the atmosphere is spinning. So this whole cloud starts rotating. And what it basically is doing is, it almost becomes, supercell almost becomes like a living entity, because they can travel hundreds of miles, basically one storm, because you've got surface winds that are feeding it moisture. You know, the supercells tend to happen mostly when we're chasing tornadoes and stuff. We are talking about the central plains of the United States. You've got the Rocky Mountains that are bordered on the, you know, the west, you know, all through, you know, through the kind of western part of the country, and then the plains are flat, and the Gulf of Mexico, just this moisture gets just rushed across the plains, and it's, you know, the dew points, if dew points are in the 50s, 60s, 70s, you've got like a crazy amount of moisture. These storms move along and they're just eating that moisture that's coming in, and the rotation is keeping them alive, where if they just kind of pulsed up and died, it wouldn't do anything. So supercells are a rotating thunderstorm, and that's what usually spurns a tornado. That's what a tornado is kind of born from.
It also gives it that shape it looks like the spaceship kind of look to them.
Mothership is what everyone likes to say. A mothership. I try to reserve it only for true motherships, almost like the word haboob. I've started to try to be like, I'm not going to use it.
You're
all
very
the
discerning.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's one of these things when you've been doing it a long time and you see new people coming up and whatever, and then you're on social media. We all know what social media is. There's so much clickbait and stuff like that. And the people will post something and go, oh my gosh, this mothership is insane. And I'm like, man, that is not a mothership. That is just a supercell. And that's just, you know, that's just being a grouchy old man probably. But yes, that's what you get. You get that shape, that's what we go after.
And I notice a lot of these mothership type supercell images have this color on the inside. It's like a deep turquoise blue. Mm-hmm. But where is that color coming from?
Generally, from what I've learned, is that greenish, bluish sometimes color is from the hail and the way the sun is reflecting off it. And it can, you know, when you think about a storm and you don't even see the sun, but you see that color, you're like, well, how's that? How's the sun have anything to do with it? But I mean, the sun is visible above you in the clouds, and it's shining through those updrafts, and it's reflecting off the ice and the moisture and the rain and stuff, and it creates that color somehow. And the color is great. Sometimes you see it. Sometimes it's, you know, really evident. Sometimes it's kind of like the storm is going up and it's still, you know, babyish, but you can kind of tell, you're like, man, you can already see like that turquoise blue or that deep blue up in there, going, that's hail up in there, and it's flashing. And
wow.
I love that color.
You know, storm chasing, especially for tornadoes in the Midwest mm-hmm. during the spring months, has become super, super popular with photographers and tourists, thrill seekers. There was a recent study done at the University of Missouri School of Natural Resources where they interviewed tourists who signed up for storm chasing tours. And they were asked a series of questions about their lives, mm-hmm. their careers, personalities, that sort of thing, very in depth. And they found that, I guess surprisingly, they scored only moderately for thrill seeking behavior, especially when compared to other high sensation seeking pursuits like rock climbing and skydiving. And here's a quote from their research paper, quote, "Hang glider pilots, mountain climbers, skiers, rock climbers, whitewater kayakers, and stunt flyers all displayed high levels of sensation seeking across all dimensions. The results from this survey may suggest that storm chasers are different from other risk-taking recreation activity participants because their personalities seem to be more drawn to new experiences rather than risky ones," unquote. Mm-hmm. So would you agree?
For me personally, I'm not a thrill seeker. I just spent a weekend at the water park with my kid, and I could care because his birthday, and he had his friends there. I'm like, I'm glad he has his friends. I can sit here and read a book. I did not care about going down big slides and stuff like that. So I'm not really looking to do this new thrilling, crazy thing. Even though I did do rock climbing and rappelling back in the day, forgot about that. But I do tours myself, and I, you know, they're small. So I only have a couple of people at a time that come along, but I can tell from them, a lot of them are interested in it and they want to see what it's like. And I don't know that, you know, the people that go with me, they see my work, they want to go with me because they want to capture the images and see the things that I've shared. And so they're generally photographers. Even though I've had a guy go with me who literally just, I think he had binoculars around his neck and didn't really care to take pictures that much. He just wanted to be there. But then none of them are ever running around like, this is crazy. Can we get closer? Can we do this and that? Like, they're looking for that adrenaline thrill seeking rush. They just are, I think they're there to experience it and see what it's like.
Curiosity.
Yeah. And it's not like some of them come back, you know, year after year because they love it and they're, you know, photographers and they just want to keep doing it. And sometimes they come, you know, a few times and then they're like, well, that was cool. And then they don't do it again. They kind of just something they tried. So I don't know. There are for sure storm chasers out there that want to get close. They love that rush. They love being right next to a tornado. And for me, I personally get a little freaked out being too close. I want to capture images and time lapse, and I don't want to be in giant hail. I don't want to risk dying. I mean, I got three kids and a wife. It's not worth it to me. So even that storm I talked about at the beginning, Fort Stockton with the lightning, I mean, I had these tour guests standing out there by a barbed wire fence. And then the Nat Geo guys, Keith, they're all out there. And I'm like sitting in the back of my 4Runner with the hatch up going, you guys are stupid. I'm back here terrified of this lightning. So I'm definitely not like, I'm going to run out here and hold my hands up and lightning striking all around me. And, you know, I'm going to Thor this thing. I have a healthy fear of that stuff. So I don't necessarily wouldn't consider myself a thrill seeker either.
We'll be right back to the show after this short message. This episode is brought to you by Case Filters. Look, I travel the world with my camera, and I can use any photography filter I like. And trust me, I've tried them all. But I only trust my photos to Case Filters. That's Case with a K, K-A-S-E. Why? Well, they're made with premium materials, HD optical glass, shockproof, no color cast, unlike some filters I've used in the past, round and square filter designs, magnetic systems, filter holders, adapters, step-up rings, everything I need so I never miss a moment. And now my listeners can get 10% off the Case Filters Amazon page when they visit beyondthelens.fm/case and use coupon code Burnaby10. Check it out. beyondthelens.fm/case. Use Burnaby10 at checkout for 10% off your Case Filters Amazon order. Case Filters, capture with confidence. There's an article in the Yale Climate Connections, and I'm supposing that's Yale University. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the article describes storm chasing as a dangerous pursuit based on data, not because of the storms themselves, but because of all the driving required to chase. And it goes on to cite example after example of horrific car accidents by up-and-coming meteorologists and storm chasers while crisscrossing the Midwest chasing storms. So how much driving do you do in a year and while you're chasing storms, and is that a concern?
Oh, yeah, it's the biggest concern. I don't worry too much about dying from a tornado or a lightning strike or giant hail. I'm more worried about other drivers. And personally, I had our friend from Arizona, Corbin Yeager. He got T-boned by two chasers that were not respecting the laws, going 65, 70 through stop signs, just not even slowing down, all captured on live stream, by the way. So it's all, you know, we all knew what they were doing. And they T-boned our friend Corbin, and they all three died. One of them wasn't even wearing a seatbelt. One of them wasn't wearing a seatbelt. We got thrown out of the car. There's only been, that I know of, the big Tim Marshall and his son and Carl Young are the only ones that I know that have really died because of a tornado. I'm sure I'm missing someone or not thinking about it, but I know the number of people who've actually died from the weather itself. Even, I think I even know someone who got struck by lightning chasing storms and he survived. Like, it wasn't, he didn't even die from that. So the people that have died have been in situations like that. There was a guy, I believe, Andy Gabrielson. There were a lot of people. He was a great chaser before my time, but he got killed by a drunk driver on his way back home. And 2 years ago, horrible, horrible. There was three students from OU, meteorology students, that, and that's where, you know, Reed Timmer, he's like the most famous storm chaser out there. That's where he went to school. And so these three storm chasers went out. I might have even seen them. They saw their first tornado that day. They were just over the moon, and they drove home that night. If you imagine, like, they never really been probably been out chasing that much. They're there for meteorology. They saw their first tornado, and they're on their way home, and they hydroplaned in pouring rain and slid off the road and slid back in and got hit by a semi. And I think all three of them died.
Now, I was listening to an interview with some storm chaser, and I can't remember his name, I'm sorry, but he was asked, what's the most dangerous thing you encounter chasing storms? And he deadpanned, wet roads.
Yeah. Dude, wet roads. I was a couple years ago, I had a BBC crew with me. We were filming a show about lightning for 12 days, and we were driving just out in southern Arizona and driving to a big wall of storm, rain, and some hail. And on camera, I'm like, these are the kind of things on the interstate that lead to hydroplaning because people aren't used to this. And so when you know it, like, we do this little thing. We do a U-turn to go back to try to find a wash that's flowing. And there's a car upside down in the median who obviously just hydroplaned from that storm. And I've seen that. I've even years ago, I driving through pouring going, oh, this is a little sketchy. I'm going to slow down because I can usually feel the road. And I flipped around and came back, and there was a car in the median, upside down, tires still spinning. And I know they hydroplaned off the freeway. And I checked on to make sure they're okay, and they were fine and waiting for police and stuff. But it's very, very dangerous. But the fact of the matter is even, you know, if it's not hydroplaning, it's just, to answer your first question, I think was, I probably put on 40, 50,000 miles a year, and I don't even drive crazy like other people do. There's people that chase full time from like April to, you know, June that are just all over the place. I kind of limit my time a little bit. So the road and the traffic and the other, we have to be careful. There's so many videos of chasers in like a line driving and someone who decides they're more important than the others and passing them all on like a double yellow with like a hill in the way, even like a radar truck not a few years ago passed in pouring rain on a double yellow where you couldn't really see over a hill and they were passing other chasers. And it's just like, what are we doing?
So the pressure to get the shot or get the video, the coverage.
There is a little bit of that. I mean, you gotta, you know, it's one of those things. I drive really safe, but then when we get in a stormy situation and you gotta like get in front of a storm, or you're going to be, you can either get in front of it or you can be behind it and kind of screwed the rest of the day. You might step on the gas a little bit and speed, and everybody speeds, you know, chasers, that's what, but it's not the speeding that's really dangerous. It's the other stuff. And yeah, it's the disregard for, you know, other drivers and passing and arrogance and stuff like that, that gets really tough.
So what kind of precautions do you take when it comes to dealing with storms, tornadoes, high winds, lightning?
I really don't take a whole lot of precaution when it comes to lightning. If it's, like I said, if it's close, then I'm usually setting up cameras and then jumping back in my car and letting the cameras do the work. And I'm just trying to be safe. I've definitely been very close to lightning strikes within, you know, 40, 50 feet multiple times. And it's, one of these days it's going to be a little closer. So I try, if it feels like that, I'm in the car, but for me, it's, you know, being safe is more being aware of road networks, looking at the radar, knowing, like where we just talked about, other chasers, where they are. You know, we were on a storm north of Clovis, New Mexico this year. Ton of chasers, basically one road. And we stopped to shoot it. I could see the headlights of like 50 cars coming down the road. And I'm like, we got to go now because we're not going to get stuck in that conga line and have like get stuck in this giant hail. So, you know, we just get out there and race at, get out of the, you know, the spot we were at as fast as we could to, you know, be safe. And so for me, a lot of it is being aware of the situation, knowing this storm is bearing down on us. We're good. All we got to do is go south or east and we're safe. But if you're not paying attention and suddenly the storm's bearing down and you realize that road south doesn't exist and I wasn't really paying attention, suddenly you're like, oh, we're going to ride this out or we're in trouble and stuff like that. So those are the kind of things I try to be really aware of. The wind has not been too much of a problem. That's mostly worried about your tripods and stuff falling over, which just happens. I try really hard to, people are like, you weigh them down, you use like sandbags. And I'm like, I don't really have time for that. I'm in and out of the truck and setting stuff up so fast for me. I could go, okay, well, I'll go run back in and get a sandbag. But if I do that, then it weighs it down. It drops the camera lower. My time lapse has been messed up. And I just get the legs wide as I can and do my best to put the, you know, position it so the leg is pointing in the direction the wind is, so it can't like tip backwards. Of course, I make mistakes and they fall over. But, you know, Canon, Nikon, those are tough cameras. They'll survive.
I have put your mind through hell. They're still going.
Yeah.
So you see a storm developing, and it could be a tornado or a boob, or it could be a mesocyclone. Do you have a particular approach? I mean, do you set up one camera, two cameras? You know, what's your level of preparedness? Because I'm assuming things are happening quickly. Like you said, you don't have time to really weigh things down stabilize things.
Yeah, sometimes you know, hey, I'm going to probably be here like 30, 40 minutes. I'm waiting for the storm to come. And you could do that. But generally, if you got that much time, it's probably not as windy as you know, it's going to be later when you're really close. For me, I'm generally time-lapsing with two cameras at all times. I currently still have two 5DSRs that, even though they're older, they still rock. They're still sharp. 50 megapixels is great. They can do 1 second intervals with the CF card. So they're awesome. I still, you know, they're trusty. I love them. And then I use an R5, hoping to maybe see if I can drop some cash and get the new, 10 to something that they just came out with
for 10 to 20,
10 to 20 RF one. Oh man. So I might have to drop some coin before chase season, cause I think it'd be fun to put that on that. The R5 just native, because I have the adapter and I use the 11-24, which is also a freaking great lens. But when you're chasing supercells and you're right there on those motherships, sometimes you cannot get wide enough. You just don't have any idea how big they are until they're right in front of you. And when you can shoot at 11 or 12 millimeter and get the whole thing almost straight up above you, it's just gorgeous, you know? And so I don't know, I'm really curious how the 10 millimeter will go and if I even want to go that wide, but it'd be nice to have it.
For lightning, do you use a lightning trigger or you just shoot successive images with an intervalometer?
I have a lightning trigger or two that I use during the day. When it gets dark enough that you can do longer exposures, like, you know, 2-3 seconds, I generally just start to do that because I'd rather not miss anything. And at the same time, as a time lapser, if I do, you know, shots over and over and over and happen to get lucky and catch bolts in it, that's also great because I'm doing two things at once.
You're time lapsing. You can extract just individual images from the time lapse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're just, you know, they're single frames. Your camera's just taking single frames every second. We were on a lightning storm, I believe it was last year in Oklahoma, and we just had this storm slowly kind of moving towards us. It wasn't like crazy supercell, just more of a line. And there was lightning every couple seconds, it felt like, in the distance. And my time lapse, I was shooting at every second. I had like 700-800 frames, maybe more, maybe 1,300 frames. I don't know. I had so much lightning in the time lapse. It's unbelievable. If I just did it at 30 frames a second and native and let it last for like 40 seconds, you'd probably see 100 strikes in there or something. So you can catch them just doing, you know, 1 second kind of intervals. And then if you're, you know, you're like, I don't want to waste all these shutter clicks and take, you know, all these pictures. Well, then you can turn it into a time lapse later. And that's kind of nice too.
Yeah. So this is a question that I was thinking about when you were first describing the tornado in Texas mm-hmm. at the very beginning of the interview. When you see a tornado developing or any serious storm that could possibly do damage mm-hmm. or even kill people,
yeah.
I've always been curious about the cognitive dissonance happening because you want a successful shoot. You want that funnel cloud to come down. Are you really rooting for the storm? Because you're probably the only people there that are rooting for the storm. Everybody else is hoping that it doesn't happen, and you're hoping that it happens. So tell me what you're thinking or how you're thinking. That's always been a curiosity to me.
Man, it is one of those tough things, right? I always would kind of compare it to, and I don't remember if I've heard this comparison from other people, but it's like war photographers. This is obviously very different, but there's photographers in war times that are out there documenting what happens in places. And it's very important. And they're shooting people in agony. People have just been killed. People that are maybe getting killed in the moment that they're shooting. And are they hoping that someone gets shot? No, but they know it's going to happen. And they know they want to tell the story because maybe it's a story that needs to be told. You know, people
and need people to get shot to tell the story.
Yeah. And they don't want that, but they put themselves in the place where this is happening because they need to capture this. And this is what's happening. If they ran out there to try to stop it, they would just get killed. And that doesn't do anything compared to them being able to tell the story so that the rest of the world or whatever gets involved. That's just, you know, one little analogy is totally, I would say, kind of different.
Yeah.
However, since my method of chasing is usually in front of the storm and away from it, not necessarily right underneath it, there are a lot of chasers that are underneath it, behind it, tornado goes through, destroys a house, they stop and go in and rescue people sometimes if they need it or pull people out of rubble. So they're there kind of hoping a tornado drops. They want to document it, but they will also do that. And, you know, I've done stuff not akin to that. That's amazing. I know these guys who've done it. They're good friends of mine and stuff. I've helped people in other ways, you know, where I met a family that might've been that Texas day, actually the tornado day. There was a family at a gas station and the mom was just crying, freaking out, panic attacking because of the storms and tornado warnings and the car, you know, goes off on your phone. Your phone goes nuts when there's a warning. She was panicking. And I walked over and I checked, make sure they're okay. Told the dad, hey, look, here's the radar on my phone. You guys are here. All you got to do is drive west and you're out of it. You'll be safe or go sit behind this wall here at this gas station and just wait it out and you're going to be okay. And it calmed them down. And so in some ways I'm there to document this, but I also am an expert and know what's going on and can kind of lend some advice. We've had police, ambulances, you know, first responders kind of going, hey, what's the storm doing? Are we okay if we, you know, stuff like that. And we've been able to tell them things like that.
They're contacting you.
Yeah. Because they don't know exactly. Some of them don't know what's going on. Some obviously live out there and they do. So, but in general, there is a, you know, you see tornadoes maybe about to drop, like the Fort Stockton one. I'm like, as long as it's not hitting the freeway, there's nobody out here. Please drop. Like, it's not going to do anything except rip up some drop. Cactus, right? And some some grass. But there was a couple of years ago, we were on the edge of Lubbock, actually in town, watching a storm come and a funnel start to drop in. And you're like, man, this will be a cap on the day if the tornado drops right now after everything we've seen. But then I'm like, I don't want this to drop. There's neighborhoods right west of here, and that's where the storm is right now. Yeah. And so there's like a crazy tough kind of debate there where I'm like, you know, I really don't care. I really don't want this to drop on a neighborhood.
On the other hand, you don't really have any say if it's going to happen or not.
You don't. You have no say. So
it's not your fault that it's going to happen.
It's not. But I think the tough part is if something like that does happen and, you know, people are hopping up and down and in jubilation while they see like maybe a neighborhood get ripped
probably
up,
bad.
There's a little bit of a different kind of thing. Like, yeah, I'm here. I got this great photo. But, you know, it's like years ago in 2016, I captured the Wynnewood tornado. You can see that tornado at the beginning of the freaking Tiger King show, the first episode. But I was there and it was like a major moment for me. I wanted to get a tornado on time lapse and I did it. And I was in tears afterwards. I texted my wife, like, I did it. She said, I'm so proud of you. And I was just emotional, kind of wrecked, because this was what I had been trying to get. However, you know, an old man died in that tornado. And I read about it later, and there might've been, maybe it might've been something like he was kind of like, his wife died a year before. He might've been just going like, hey, I'm kind of done. I know he was lonely from the story I read, but regardless, it was kind of sobering. At the same time, going, this is going through a little bit more of like a rural area, but some farms and things like that. And there's a chance that, and so that was a tough thing. You know, it's,
yeah,
I'm there. The tornado, like you said, tornado is going to happen regardless. But I'm there to document it. And that's what I do, is to try to capture these things. And I think as long as you at least realize, you know, there are people affected by all this stuff, you know, that it's, you got to kind of keep that in perspective for sure.
So which weather apps or tools do you use to track the weather when you're out there chasing?
Generally, most people use Radar Scope on their phones.
Radar Scope?
Radar Scope. I think it's one word, S capitalized. There's also Radar Omega. I get really stuck in my ways and just stick with Radar Scope. It's kind of nice now. They've added a little more detailed maps to it and terrain, so you can kind of see that. That was a desire for a very long time. They finally added it. That's for, you know, iOS. On a PC, I don't know that Radar Scope is out for PC, but it probably is. But on my car, when I'm driving, I also have like a Surface Pro on at all times in the car, and I use something called GR Level 3, and it's a PC only program. And it's basically the same thing as Radar Scope, but you can add so much more to it with technical stuff, place files, and all these layers you can add to it. And that one's really good to have in the car. Taking people out, tour guests, they like to see that. They're like, where are we? And I can show them what the storm's doing. They can look at it anytime they want. And so they're not just like, what's going on? And I have to show them my phone, but they can see the radar kind of in the vehicle. So that's the best, you know, way. But I use multiple things. You know, I'm using Google Maps to look at roads, and there's plenty of times where Google will show a road going down and joining another one. And we went out there in South Colorado. We're trying to chase a storm and we're taking this dirt road, and I got a 4Runner 4x4 now. So a little braver than I used to be. And man, we took that dirt road and it started disappearing, and suddenly there's a barbed wire fence in front of us. And we're like, Google, you screwed us. So it's one of those things where we use Google a lot to really zoom in to see, does this road actually connect, or is it just going into a, you know, so I use that a ton.
You have a series of just mind blowing time-lapse videos.
Thank you. Yes.
Titled Vorticity.
Yep.
And you have five of them.
Yeah. I just put out five in the fall. The fifth one, I think, in the fall. Yeah.
They're on your YouTube channel at Michael Binsky.
Yep. And Vimeo. I think on Vimeo too. Yeah. They're
Vimeo
on
Vimeo too. Just mind blowing.
Thank
you. Watching these videos and I'm thinking two things. First, the amount of post-processing work that would be required makes me never want to do such a project.
It's ridiculous.
But mostly, and I can appreciate how you really need to anticipate what's going to happen, because the camera's stationary as the storm is evolving and moving, and you have to anticipate and be in the right place and sit up in the right place.
Yeah.
Is that just experience, or is there more to it than that?
It's experience. Sometimes it's luck. I mean, weather in a lot of ways, weather is, there's a lot of, I guess it's almost like luck. You know, what's going to happen. There's a lot of meteorology that will tell you today's going to be a great day. And the way that the shear is today it could be the mothership kind of day. I know when supercells are moving to the southeast, they almost always have better structure than other storms that are moving northeast. That's just the way it is.
That's experience.
It's experience. And so for me, I know, hey, guys, this storm's moving southeast. It's going to be a great day. And most of the time, it turns out it is, unless it's just freaking janky and the clouds are low and it just sucks or something. But so that's experience. And it's funny because you mentioned you obviously watch the videos and you can pick that up for yourself. You know, every now and then I'll get comments like, how come you don't do any like motion stuff and panning? And I'm like, do you know how hard it is already for me to figure out the direction that it's going and to set up my camera? And even though I have experience doing it, I set up my camera, even a 12 millimeter, and it'll slide to the left or the right more than I wanted and piss me off because I can't, because I missed it. It goes out of frame and now I'm going to have to crop or something. So even after all that, you know,
that was my
it's
point.
Still hard. It's still hard. So you want to set up, you want me to stop and set up a Motomo panning head and try to like pan with the storm moving by and guess how fast it's moving and how many frames I need to shoot and how much I need to pan to get I love weather and chasing it and sharing it. I don't want to overcomplicate it. That's why I probably don't use a drone either, because it's just too much going on. And I want to do what I love, and that's the way I'm going to do it. But it's tough, but it's a ton of experience going, this is what's about to happen. And I'm going to set up my camera in the right place. And more often than not, you know, you get it right, but there are still the days when you don't.
What do you use to make the time lapse? Are you using Lightroom or are you using some other program?
I use, I guess like four programs. I use Lightroom to kind of dump the photos. Actually, usually just dump them directly to the hard drive and then organize them in Lightroom and kind of do some base, you know, editing presets, stuff like that to kind of make sure they all have the same look. And then I go to LR Timelapse, which is the holy grail of time-lapse tools that's out there. It's the Mecca. I don't know. Gunther hadn't developed that program, I don't know what we'd all be doing.
LR time lapse.
It actually stands for level ramping time lapse, but everyone looks at it and thinks Lightroom.
Yeah.
When you see the LR. And the thing is it works great with Lightroom. It goes back and forth by using the XMP files, like as a communication kind of pathway where it saves stuff to the XMP, you bring it into Lightroom, you see what it did. So that program is insane. I can make shutter speed changes throughout my time lapse where, you know, it's an ugly jump, right? From exposure changes. LR time lapse sees all that, ramps it out. You can ramp you got a sunset, it goes to blue hour, gets a little darker. Your white balance, if you kept it at 5,000 Kelvin, it's going to look a little weird. So you can ramp your white balance. You can ramp your noise reduction. You can just do so much stuff. You can use a gradient, ramp a gradient in his program. So that's where we do a lot of work, but a lot of people in that program lets you create video files from it. You can export it and all that stuff. I use After Effects to import the raw like sequence and create video files from that.
I'm going to put links to this stuff in the show notes so people can check it out.
Perfect. And I do Premiere Pro to kind of put it all together. There's also a plugin. I think it's from Digital Anarchy called Flickr Free. It's a plugin that goes with After Effects and Premiere Pro. And it is like, LR Timelapse has the ability to get rid of flicker in your timelapse. If for whatever reason I do a lens twist with Canon. I don't want to get too detailed, but if you get any kind of flicker in there, LR Timelapse can get rid of it. But sometimes it's not always perfect. And then this flicker free plugin will just boom. It takes a little bit longer to export your file when this plugin is trying to analyze everything, but it's a godsend. So that's also a great one.
Great information.
Yeah.
You're an Emmy winning storm photographer, cinematographer. Yeah. Is it a photographer or cinematographer?
I don't know.
Come on. Don't be modest.
I say filmmaker, but then I hate that too because I'm like, I just make time-lapse films. Some people are going to hire me to like make a movie. I don't know what to do.
So what did you do to win an Emmy?
Well, I licensed footage to the station down the street, the news station. I used to downplay it a lot, but some people told me to stop doing that. But there's a station, AZ Family, Channel 3. There's a meteorologist there named Royal Norman, who is a legend. He's been on Channel 3 or something in the Valley. He's been there for 25, 30 years. I should probably know. I grew up watching him, and now we're friends. It's insane. And so every year they would do this monsoon special for, you know, they aired on a Sunday night or whatever. And it's to teach everybody, you know, what the monsoon is coming. What are we worried about? What are the dangers? Stuff like that. He's like, I want to license all your footage. I'm going to pay for it myself. I'm going to give you a photographer credit on the show. I want it to enhance what we're trying to show people and teach them about storms. This, your videos and your time lapses of dust storms and all this stuff will be way better than anything we have of like still camera, like, or not, but like TV camera kind of footage of stuff. So they just loaded it with my stuff, got nominated for an Emmy. And then we went to the casino, or this casino's big resort casino, and for the South Rocky Mountain Emmys, that's the chapter or whatever, and bought my first suit ever. I've only worn it once for that, and I've never worn a suit again. And my wife got real dressed up, and we went with all the people from Channel 3 and sat at a big table. And then Jim Cantore, who's the god of weather, the hurricane god, he did a recorded, you know, presentation of it for us, saying these are the nominations. And I could not. I'm like, Jim Cantore's doing this. Are you kidding? And then there was two winners in our category, and we won. And we got to go up there and get the Emmy and stuff. So I'm really proud of it. I know that I would downplay it a lot, because it's not like I made Vorticity 5 and Vorticity 5 won an Emmy, and so therefore it was all me. This was a collaborative thing, and they used it. But they told me, they're like, it would not have won. It would not be as good without your footage, you know, enhancing it. So very proud of that.
Congratulations.
It's kind of nice to have.
That's so cool.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Someday I'll get another one. Hopefully, maybe.
So what are you more passionate about? Extreme weather or photography and filmmaking? Or phrased another way, are you a photographer who chases storms or a storm chaser who does photography?
I think it's that latter. Because I find myself not wanting to go out and just shoot mundane things, you know, anymore. It's more of, I don't know, man, that's a tough question. Cause I can go out and chase a storm, and if I forgot my camera gear, I'd probably just be like, well, I'm just going home, because I'm going to be maybe out of frustration because I couldn't capture what I'm seeing.
So that would mean that you're a photographer who does storm chasing.
Yeah,
you're a photographer
maybe.
First.
Yeah. I feel like that they almost go hand in hand. Like because one of my favorite things is not to chase, I guess, and sit on my back porch if a storm's coming with like an old fashioned and enjoy the weather like I used to, because that's what I like to just sit and experience it. And I really like it if I'm at home, because I can see how it's flooding my house and just kind of enjoy it, because it always was, you know, for me, I think, it's like sitting outside if it's pouring rain and thundering, to me, is relaxing and calming. And sitting outside with a drink and enjoying it is like, this is my happy place. Other people get terrified and scared, and that's not fun for them at all. Or depressed because they used to live in Seattle, they moved to Arizona, and they hate it when it rains and storms because it reminds them of home or something. And so for me, I don't know. It's a calming, relaxing thing. So I think I've always been more of, I love the weather, and then photography has been a way to share it with people. So I don't take my camera everywhere I go like I used to.
I don't either.
So I don't know.
Don't.
It's bad for my kids, man, because I used to take so many pictures of them, and now all this stuff happens. And I'm literally first day of school and Halloween, I take pictures, and that's about it.
What would you consider to be more dangerous, an EF5 tornado or an erotic mother of the bride 2 hours before a wedding?
Yeah. I would say
that's my unsubtle way of saying you do wedding photography too.
I do. I would be very scared of an EF5 tornado. That's very big. But no, I don't like dealing with grouchy moms. Luckily, I've been pretty lucky with my style of wedding photography and just in general of kind of relaxing vibes for people, that the clients that hire me for their weddings, they tend to be pretty chill, relaxed like me. The philosophy of we want to have a great time with our friends and family, and we don't really care about all this other stuff, but we want the best photos that we can get. But they don't really, they're not, like you said, no one's neurotic about, you got to capture this and you got to do this and how do I look like this and is this the best you know, they just are like, Mike's going to do the job and we want to have a good time. And that's the greatest attitude to have on your wedding anyway, I think. You know, the people who are more worried about how their pictures are going to look, and that they're going to get into a magazine, they're the ones that scare the crap out of me. I'm like, I don't want, that's not why I do this. I love people and the moments and the things that happen at weddings. You know, just one of these last ones, it was just like, this girl was so, this lady later in life, she's older than me. It's first time getting married. She was just in tears. She was telling me that she was so excited that I captured her wedding. And she's like, I feel like you lowered yourself to shoot my wedding. Like you went, like you lowered your standards. And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. First off, everybody deserves to have their story told. And I feel like I'm saying this because wedding photography is probably like, you're a storm chaser. You want an Emmy, but then you shoot weddings. Like that's like beneath you, or that doesn't make sense. And I'm like, you know what? Weddings are, they're fantastic. People are great. There's so many cool stories out there. And this girl lady, she found the one, you know, she got married. And there's little kids running around, and you stop, and like these kids are like throwing flowers in there, and you capture it. And it's like this beautiful moment where some little flower girl's tossing flowers, and it wasn't planned. And it's like, those are the things that's kind of what I love, you know, in some regards, just capturing those moments. Storm chasing is almost the same thing. You're capturing kind of things as they happen and hoping, you know, it's something good.
All right. So for people who want to see your work, where's the best place?
Probably Instagram and YouTube. And my website. I would bring up my Facebook page, but it got hacked in October and I still don't have it. And Meta sucks. And I've been paying them money for verified support and it's done nothing. I've even had two Canadian papers write about it because the people that hacked my page started running ads for
That's terrible.
Clickbait for crypto, and the Canada papers wrote about it. So, but look, if you search my name, you'll find all the
places. Let's make it easier. MikeOlbinski.com.
Yep.
Last name is spelled OlbinSki.
Yep.
You could see time-lapse videos there, or is that on your YouTube channel?
They're on my website. Going to YouTube or Vimeo is the best way. Going to YouTube, I have the time-lapse videos, and I have a lot of chase vlogs I've been doing lately where you can just see like kind of like a whole day of the chase. Sometimes I talk to the camera like, what are we trying to do today? And this is what we're trying to see. And then boom, you see the result of it. And yeah, you see chaser interaction and other people with me it's kind of fun. So it's a little bit of a different kind of video than the time-lapse stuff.
And Instagram is at Mike Olbinski.
Yep.
And you can subscribe to his exclusive content there as well.
Yeah, I do have a Patreon page where I probably post more. The Instagram stuff has been a little bit tougher for me to figure out, but I have a Patreon page where I post forecasts and wallpapers and
awesome.
More behind-the-scenes stuff, tutorials and things like that.
Worth taking a look, folks. Really awesome stuff.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Anything else? Any parting words?
No, I just hope the sound was good. No, Richard, I appreciate you having me on, and I'm glad we got to do this.
You sound fantastic.
No, I'm excited. Oh, the other thing I would say is I don't know when this is going to come out, but stormphotocontest.com is happening right now. If you have a storm photo, you can submit it to it. If you don't, and if this comes out later in March, go to stormphotocontest.com and see the amazing work by other storm chasers around the world. Storm chasing is a global thing, and it's fantastic seeing photos captured everywhere. In places like France, you wouldn't believe has like fantastic lightning. So that's really fun.
Fantastic. Mike, thanks so much for coming on. This is really a lot of fun.
Great. Thanks for having me, Richard. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Beyond the Lens with me, Richard Burnaby. Thanks to Mike Olbinski for taking the time to join me in this informative, entertaining, and fun conversation. And thanks to you, of course, for listening. You can tweet me at BurnabyPhoto with any comments or feedback. And if you did enjoy the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, a rating on Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'd love to hear what you think about the show and what you'd like to see from Beyond the Lens in the future. You can sign up to receive an email when a new episode drops at our website, beyondthelens.fm. Here's to truth, adventure, and passion. See you next time.